So the first, and I think you know, one of the ones that you start to see the earliest has to do with reactivity. The second one has to do with beginning to see other people differently, and see other people differently in the sense of you actually begin to see them as yourself. And what I mean by that is that these practices are practices where we are extending ourselves, we're cultivating an intention to extend ourselves to others and to treat them in a different way, to treat them in an unconditional way. And as you do this, particularly when you do this as an intensive meditative practice, what just quickly becomes unescapable, and you begin to feel this, not think it, but you begin to feel this, is that the people that you were calling up and practicing with, you know, your friend, your mother, your father who passed away, a child, the mailman, the clerk at the grocery store, it doesn't matter who it is, what starts to become clear when you begin to open your heart, when you begin to work, is that you realize that internally they are just like you are, that we are all exactly the same, that the pain and suffering that I feel, the terrible sense of isolation that I feel when I'm suffering or when I'm in self-doubt is exactly the same terrible sense of suffering and isolation that other people feel. And when you actually begin to feel that as opposed to intellectualize it, something starts to happen. And you know, the Dalai Lama talks a lot about this. He says when we don't have this feeling, what we are able to do is treat other people as separate from ourselves, which is what allows us to harm them, you know, or to demonize them, or all the different things that we do. It's the absence of that quality. So, you know, this kind of talk, because we're talking about characteristics of all the Brahmavihara, you know, this could go on. It won't. But it could go on for days, because there's so many things. But with respect to this, there's two things that start to happen. And the first one is that we slowly start to expand the circle of who we're bringing into our circle of care. You know, normally, for most of us, that circle is actually fairly small. You know, people who we have something close to kind of an unlimited sense of care. And even most of those have some conditionality to them. You know, like most committed relationships have an element to them of, you know, I love you and you love me, and part of the reason I love you is that you treat me as the person, a particular person. And if you stop treating me as that person, it starts creating problems in our relationship. So, you know, it happens sometimes when people get on the spiritual path that, you know, one person isn't, the other person is, and one person really starts changing and it threatens the hell out of the other person. You know? So, there's a lot of conditionality and attachment in most of our relationships. And so, this is starting to open this up to a larger circle of people and loosening the conditionality and the attachment. And you've probably heard this quotation. This is from Albert Einstein. And it's beautiful in the, you know, when you take it out of context, but for me it becomes really meaningful when you understand the context of this quotation. And so the context for Einstein saying this, And you may know that Einstein was, believed that we had two minds. We had a rational mind and an intuitive mind. And the rational mind was a wonderful servant, but the intuitive mind was where all of our wisdom was. And that in our culture, we had become lost because we got it reversed. We believe that the rational mind should be put first rather than the intuitive mind. And, you know, he said that, you know, all of the great scientific discoveries, that when they first came to him, none of them came to him in a form that you could identify as anything that the rational mind would classify as language or speech. But they came to him as images and feelings, which then eventually got translated. So Einstein had a rabbi approach him whose 16-year-old daughter had been killed. And he asked Einstein how he could explain why his daughter had been killed to his other daughter, who was 19 years old. And the rabbi described the 16-year-old as a young girl who was sinless, beautiful, and a 16-year-old child. And he said, how can I explain this to my other daughter? So that's the context for this, I think, a really beautiful quotation, which is really descriptive of what we're talking about. He says, a human being is a part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He or she experiences themselves, their thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest. A kind of optical delusion of consciousness. Exactly what the Dalai Lama is saying, right? This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. So, I mean, that is really the essence of the teaching when we're talking about these mind states being unlimited, unconditional, and unmeasurable, is that that circle just keeps expanding. So the second thing is that you start to feel barriers between yourself and other people start to soften and dissolve rather than be oppositional. So when I said earlier that, you know, that there's a number of relationships which I honestly thought would never heal at all, ever. And in the last 5 or 6 years have really had some significant transformations in them. And this includes people in our Sangha. My relationship with them, where due to limitations on my part and unwise action, and maybe the same thing on their part, we really hurt each other. But you start this practice, and you start to see that you start to feel the origins of this. You know, aren't so personal, that they have to do with two people suffering and being confused about each other's motives and not knowing how to communicate and not trusting each other. And then you keep working with this, and then you start to see that more deeply. And as I said, you know, it gives you the courage to be willing to take risks, or at least what you think are risks, you know, emotional risks, that you were fearful to do before. So, you know, the archetypal image of compassion is Kuan Yin. And one of the things I say about Kuan Yin is Kuan Yin hears the voices of all the suffering in the world. It's an extraordinary cacophony of suffering, you know, pouring down on you. And what it does not say is that Kuan Yin hears the suffering, the voices of all the suffering in the world, and flinches or closes her heart or restricts herself or tries to protect herself. It's just the reverse. She opens her heart and embraces the suffering of other beings. And so the nature of this is you move from your intuitive response is to restrict, you know, to become rigid, to protect yourself, to open and become flexible and to absorb things. And so suddenly you have the capacity to handle things that you couldn't handle before. You know, what makes it so difficult for us to handle things? You know, when we have self-judgment, self-criticism, when we think we're inadequate, when we have doubt, what happens to us? We start to constrict. You know? We start to feel inadequate. We start to feel like we can't do it. We become afraid. We don't want to take a risk. And so this is just the reverse. It's that intuitively you start seeing that those states of mind are actually hurting you and hurting others because you're not extending yourself to others. And so your response starts to become to open. Now, at the beginning, it's little baby openings. You know, maybe it's so small, it doesn't even look like an opening. And then pretty soon, you know, with the right circumstance and the right person, it's like a big opening. And then something really happens as a result of that. That your mind 2 or 3 years before would have never thought you could do. You know, this ordinary little shriveled up mind that we have. Wouldn't believe it. And then you start to realize that there's much more that's possible. I think the next thing, and it relates very closely to this, but it's really a beautiful idea, is that we begin to be committed to, it's actually a learning, but we begin to develop an intention to stay in relationship with others, even if we're in opposition, rather than closing ourselves off, rather than closing the other person off. Because we start seeing, because we know how difficult it is, and we know how painful it feels to be closed off by somebody else. We know how painful that is. So that we begin to see that part of the key to having a lasting, deep, caring, productive relationships is this ability actually to stay in relationship regardless of what's going on. No matter who's angry, who's hurt, you do not shut the door. And I think the person who really said it beautifully is Sri Ramakrishna, who was, you know, a great Indian saint Hindu, and he said, do whatever you will with another person, but never put them out of your heart. It's just such a powerful statement, you know. So these are just some of the things, but they're, to me, extraordinary things because they really are transformative. And Brahma Vihara, Vihara meaning dwelling or abode, and Brahma meaning God or Godhead. So these are frequently called the divine abodes or the divine dwellings. And they're called that precisely because they're so potentially transformational. That's the reason that kind of specific language is used. Okay, so there's just one more thing, and so this one that may or may not work, but it's true. Okay, so we have been doing this last year. We have had a year-long course called "How Can I Help?" And it's a course about service. And so, to be in the course, you had to commit to doing a certain amount of service in the community every month. And there are readings from a book by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman, and then by Joanna Mason. And I think what people are starting to see is that I think a lot of people signed up thinking the course was about service. Meaning, like, service out there in the community or something. And have ended up seeing that that's not what the course is really about. The course is about service in the sense of service to ourselves and everyone around us. It's about relationship and how kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity are fundamental and transform relationship. So when these practices start to work, we start getting these little glimpses that there's something much bigger going on here than anything that we ever suspected. And in Buddhist language, we're talking about everything being conditional and everything being interconnected and interrelated. And there's this image of what they call inverse net, where everything in the universe is all linked. And so you actually begin to have a sense that that's true. I mean, it's so big that I don't think our rational mind can. You can have an idea, you can paint a picture of it, but feeling that, you can't do that with your rational mind. Okay, so you start having glimpses that, you know, I'm looking at you and you're looking at me, but there's something beyond that that's linking both of us. That there is, at least for me, it's still a pretty big mystery that we're sitting on the earth right now in an unfathomable large universe. And somehow you start getting an inkling of this connection that makes that understandable, not in a rational way, but in a heart way, of how deeply we're connected. And when you start to touch that place, it begins to just change your understanding about everything, about what you're doing and the value of it and who you think you are and what relationships are and the value of this little planet that we're living on. And so I think it's hard to find anything at all that even gets close to describing this. And I feel like really inadequate at this part of the talk. But I'm going to read a quotation to you, which is a little bit longer, and it uses some language we don't normally use. So it talks about God and what have you. So just translate that, because for years I studied with Ram Dass, and Ram Dass doesn't believe that there's any clockwork God out there, and as a Hindu, doesn't even, and I think most people who have gone deep into the practice, that actually Hinduism and our practice are pretty close together in the end. How we get there is different, but ultimately the idea that there's something far beyond our rational mind that we can't put in a box, and it's a mystery. So this is one way that we start helping to be able to understand it. So he says, these practices open us up to an awareness within ourself which is itself unitive. That these states of mind themselves have to do with unity. Okay. Not only do we see and hear more, but our very openness and spaciousness begins to dissolve opposition and discord with others. Through these practices and our efforts to keep our hearts open in the presence of suffering, we find ourselves more available to whoever we are with. Compassion is increasingly an automatic response. We find a deep quality of love infusing our actions with others. The expression of this love in turn becomes increasingly our goal. whatever the circumstance, the more unconditionally we share it, the more helpful it is to all of us. This is the essence of the spiritual path of devotional service. One enters into the helping act not only because there is a need to be met. Service gradually becomes an offering, first to those we are with, but eventually to that greater truth or source of being in which we are all joined in unconditional love. Helping becomes an act of reverence, of worship, of gratitude. It is grace merely to have the chance to serve another human being. Mother Teresa, for example, bending to hold a dying leper, sees that there is only, quote, Christ in a distressing disguise, close quote. She's not helping a dying leper. She's loving God, affirming in whoever she's with universal qualities of beauty and perfection. One can't imagine how it might feel to be held in this spirit during one final moments on this earth. The Hindu deity Hanuman, which was Hanuman Ram Dass's favorite symbolic god, offers a similar example of devotional service. Every act he performs becomes an offering to Ram. His service brings him to the very edge of unitive life. How powerful his vision, quote, when I know who I am you, close quote, he says, kneeling before Ram, quote, when I don't know who I serve you, close quote. For both of these inspirational figures and for any of us, the smallest act of caring, making a sick friend's bed, filling a bowl of rice on a food line, welcoming a stranger, comforting a frightened friend, can be a means of affirming the greater unity of life in love. So, in the end, the Buddhist vision of liberation has to do with eventually uprooting all aversive states of qualities of mind and having them replaced with these qualities of mind, so that this idea of every act is an act of service, it's an act of service to ourselves, it's an act of service to whoever we're serving, it's an act to all of us, because we're all interconnected, and that begins to inform everything we do. Okay, so how is this possible? Why would it happen? And there's two answers. The first one is that you can hear from the nature of these qualities of mind that they create a sense of spaciousness and a sense of emotional expansiveness that allows us to hold things that we aren't normally able to hold. Okay, so the Buddha, to try to explain this, said, let's take a clump of salt, put it in a glass of water, just a little glass of water, put it in there, stir it up, okay? Try to drink it. You know, it's going to be miserable. Okay? Take that same chunk of salt, put it in a river or in a lake that's clean, and then drink that water, and you'll hardly even notice it. Okay. So, kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity begin to be the base that is holding what we see in our Vipassana work. You know, we see these really, if we don't have that base, things that feel quite brutal. You know, we see our inadequacies, we see our shortfalls, we realize that we hurt somebody and never knew that we hurt somebody. We realize how deeply we've hurt ourselves. We realize how emotionally cut off we are. All these are really painful things. But as we practice the Brahma Vihara, as the self-judgmental and self-critical voice starts to calm down, so these things can come up, and then rather than being reactive to them and trying to push them away or wall them off, we do what Kuan Yin does, is that we open to them and that we start to work with them in a new way. So that's the first reason that these other things can actually happen. The second reason is, in a way, kind of mechanistic, but it's one we all know, that reactivity has a very specific way that it rolls out from a Buddhist perspective. You know, we have desire aversion, it moves up to attachment, the mind starts contracting, we go into identification, and then we're just lost, right? We're unconscious. We hurt ourselves, we hurt other people. So what happens is that this intervenes, and it slows down, disrupts, and in many cases eliminates that whole reactive process. So once again, this serves as the base both in internally working with very deep material, whether it's in meditation or whether it's just personally reflecting or it's working with a therapist, and in our relationships with other people. There's this whole new base that informs everything. So, okay. So there's two practices. One is practicing this as a form of meditation, intensive meditation, and the other one is in relationship. Okay, so as a meditation practice, it's important to realize that all of these, all four of them, are what are considered concentration practices. Concentration practices have very specific characteristics. Characteristic is that we put our attention on something and hold it there to the exclusion of other things. So if we were sitting in meditation doing Vipassana, we're sitting here, we're focusing on our breath, and something else comes up. Our mind goes to that, and if it's stronger than the primary object, we stay with that, right? If there's pain in our knee or strong emotion that's expressing itself in our body. With these, with concentration practice, we are focused almost entirely on, in the traditional way that you do it, a repetition of phrases where you're trying to evoke this intentional emotional feeling. May you be safe and protected. May you be peaceful and happy. May you be free from suffering. You're trying to actually well that up in yourself and express that and then cultivate it. Okay? So that is done over and over again, and the only reason that you break away from that is that if you begin to notice that you're doing something that is that other than that, okay, so you realize that rather than being equanimous about it, even though there may be a strong feeling about it, that you think you're doing compassion or metta, and you notice that you're angry, okay? So you either switch to another person, or you switch to Vipassana. Or the reverse of that, you know, you're doing metta, which is supposed to be this open kindness, and you suddenly know that what you're really doing is you're really attached. You know, you're holding on rather than trying to cultivate the intention of may you be free from suffering, may you be safe. You've clamped down and you're actually wanting that to happen in the person's life. Okay? So that's no longer cultivating metta, it's you're caught in attachment. So one way is an intensive practice, and it's indispensable because just like Vipassana, the reason we do this is that we go to a depth in a retreat like this that we can't do in any other way. Or at home. In a community practice, we sit because it creates a bank account, a reserve, a well of wisdom, or these states of mind. So it's indispensable. Second way that we practice it is in relationship. So here it could be as simple as, you know, we're outside and you're at the food line, And, you know, you see somebody come in and they're really rushing and they're kind of anxious and what have you. You just step back and you let them go in front of you. Just the simplest act of kindness. You know, you see that somebody is struggling with something and you just allow them to go in the food line ahead of you. And then in daily life, when we leave here, you know, the opportunities are endless. You know, we start with, we're in relationship with somebody, and it doesn't have to be a reason. It doesn't have to be that somebody, you know, it's unconditional in the sense that we're not kind to somebody in this tradition because it's unconditional. We're not kind to somebody because we think they need it or deserve it. We're kind because kindness transforms relationships. So pick somebody out. Joseph Goldstein always tells this story about there was a boy when he was in India, and he would come and he would Joseph would put his fruit up on this window, and there were no screens, and this little Indian boy would come and steal his fruit. And so he just started doing metta for this little kid, you know, like, he doesn't know what it is, you know, whether he's, you know, just a little truant or whether he's not getting enough to eat, it doesn't matter, you know. So he just starts doing this metta. He doesn't see him for like 10 days, you know. And then he sees him, and he says his internal reaction was just like to light up. He was so happy to see this little boy, you know. So there's, you know, endless opportunities where it starts off as cognitively framing something, okay? You know, you see somebody at the store, you have the checker, what have you, and he's okay, and then you're just being kind to them, or you're actually repeating the phrases at the cash register. You know, I'll frequently do that. You know? Talking to whoever the clerk is, you know, just looking them right in the eye. You know, you're talking about something, and you're thinking, may you be safe and protected. You know, may you be happy. It sounds crazy, and it's amazing when you start doing this regularly. What it does for you. And I'm sure Rich and Diane will share experiences with you along this line. So, in a very broad sense, those are the two big categories of how we can practice. I want to close with an unlikely candidate for a closing quotation, but I'd like you to listen to how closely this quotation is to what I've been talking about, and then the quotation from Einstein. I got this expanding, and this is kind of taking it the next step. And for me, it shows that these states of mind have played an important and revered role in almost every historical religion and indigenous cultures in particular. So this is from Black Elk, who's an Oglava medicine man, and through a translator, this book was published called Black Elk Speaks, which you may have heard of. It's really kind of a gorgeous book. So he says, then I was standing on the highest mountain of them all, and round about beneath me was the whole hoop of the world. So, you know, he's speaking metaphorically here. Okay. And while I stood there, I saw more than I could tell, and I understood more than I saw. And while I stood there, I saw more than I could tell, and I understood more than I saw. For I was seeing, in a sacred way, the shapes of all things in the spirit, and the shape of all shapes as they must live together like one being. And I saw that the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one circle. Wide as daylight and as starlight, and in the center grew a mighty flowering tree to shelter all the children of one mother and one father, and I saw that it was holy. And in our tradition, we would call that one mighty flowering tree, the Dharma. So let's just sit for a few minutes.
A couple weeks later, the emperor's men come into town and draft all the young men to go off and fight in the war. But because this young man has a broken leg, he isn't taken and is the only young man in the village not to die in the war. So, I think we recognize the attitude of the neighbors, bouncing back and forth between one thing and another. The attitude of the farmer is a little bit harder to see because behind each incident, he somehow managed not to get caught up in the immediacy of it and take a bigger picture. Could be good, could be bad, too soon to tell. And as the story shows, by the end, it turned out all of the above. Each event seemed good at the time, turned out another way, then switched again. So life is like this. And as you've seen with your own experience on this retreat, any 1 minute period can be like this. We can have a moment of spontaneous insight and 30 seconds later be suffering from a pain in the body. So how do we learn to ride with all of this back and forth? There's this quality that's on many of the Buddhist lists, unlike compassion, which I talked about a couple of days ago. It's really not on many lists. And it's called equanimity. And Diane talked about the order of these lists, often metta's toward the beginning. Equanimity is almost always last on these lists. So we're talking about the Brahma Viharas. This is the fourth and final of the official Brahma Viharas. Kamala Master is called forgiveness, the fifth Brahma Vihara, sometimes when she talks on it. But of the official one that was in the original Pali Canon and in the Vasuddhimagga, equanimity is the fourth. in the place of the Brahma Viharas, it informs all of the others. There's a lay ecological activist and Buddhist from England who gave a talk at about almost exactly a year ago. I was in a training that One Earth Sangha gave called Eco-Sattva Training. And it was essentially like our climate sangha, trying to apply Buddhist wisdom to the work of climate change. And Guhyapati says, unless our equanimity grows out of a caring intimacy, deeply alive to the pulse of life, unless it holds within it a passionate and committed engagement with the suffering of the world, unless it's illuminated by joyful appreciation, it's not the equanimity the Dharma points us towards. So, in case you missed it, all the other Brahma Viharas are in there. Caring intimacy, passionate and committed engagement with the suffering of the world, and joyful appreciation. So you can see from that context that equanimity is deeply involved with the other Brahma Viharas. Also, without equanimity, none of the other Brahma Viharas really work in the way that they're supposed to. So, metta, without the balance that equanimity brings, can become sentimentality. Compassion without balance can become despair or pity. And mudita, without that kind of balance, can become, as Diane said last night, overly exuberant, sort of beyond the appropriateness of the situation. Sylvia Borstein keeps a cartoon on her bulletin board. She's a teacher at Spirit Rock, one of the co-founders, in fact. And I don't know if you know this cartoon, Sylvia. She's a sort of always frazzled middle-aged woman that she's a writer. And so Sylvia's at her typewriter. And she's making a list. And the title on the list is Remarks You Most Hope to Be Able to Make Sometime. So the first one on the list is, yes, it is unusual to win the Nobel Prize and compete in the Olympics in the same year. The second one is, I'll take the leather pants in size 2, please. Some of the men shaking their heads. Clearly some of you got that one. The third one is, no thanks, I have everything I need. No thanks, I have everything I need. Wouldn't that be nice? To just be able to say, at any moment, I mean, whether we're experiencing bodily pain or mental anguish or an unpleasant memory or, you know, a strong desire for something that hasn't been available to us on this retreat, wouldn't it be nice to say, no thanks, I have everything I need. You guys see, we've got our man in black here again tonight, so in honor of him, I'll give you a quote that Sylvia takes from Johnny Cash. The wealthiest person is a pauper at times compared to the man with a satisfied mind. But how do we get there? I mean, if we, you know, if we really care about our practice, we notice things that aren't really very pleasant. We notice old habits that just seem impossible that we'll ever shake them. We notice judgment. We notice working through the same old things that we've worked through every other retreat we've been on. Sometimes it seems like we're making no progress at all. And this quality of equanimity has within it the attitude that pleasant or unpleasant, it's not that we dampen down our appreciation or our feeling of those. It's we're adapting the right view that either one is fine. That particularly, I'm speaking here specifically of our meditation experience, that in terms of an object of our awareness, pleasant or unpleasant, either one is fine. In fact, at times, I don't know about you, but I've found that often I learn a lot more from my unpleasant experiences than I do from the pleasant. That's where the real learning goes on. That's where the real opportunity arises to actually change a habit. We're probably not going to change a habit when it's making us feel good. We're going to change it when it causes us misery and we actually notice the misery instead of passing by it or labeling it as something else, rationalizing it, saying, well, actually that does feel good when I think about how terrible that other person is and what they did to me. You know, that's the kind of rationalization that can keep us from really facing the misery that we're in. This word, English word, equanimity, comes from two words. I think many of us know the word upekkha. That's the word that's in the list of the Brahma Viharas. And Gil Fronsdal tells us that that word means to look over. Not to overlook, but to look over. In the sense of kind of looking and taking in the whole picture. To really look something over. Taking in the whole picture. The pleasant, the unpleasant. And I didn't know until I was researching this talk that there's a second word that's often translated as equanimity. And Gil says it's tatra maja tata. So that's three words, all kind of smashed together like they do in German. Tatra means there, and it's sometimes referred to as all these things. Maja means middle, you know, like in Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses. And tata means to stand or to pose. So putting them all together, Gil suggests we might translate that as to stand in the middle of all this that's life. And that's the thing I want to keep emphasizing over and over again with equanimity, is that it is not standing apart. It is standing in the middle of all this. It is not detachment in the sense of pushing something away or not being intimate with it, as Guhyapati said. It's really standing right in the middle of the center and being willing to feel it all and yet not being knocked off balance by that. Joanna Macy in the Ecosattva training said that paralysis and panic are the ditches on either side of the uphill path toward the future. Paralysis and panic are the ditches on either side of the uphill path toward the future. And I don't know about you, I mean, at times I feel hopeful about the future, but many times when I think about the future, it's not a happy sight. And so it's going to require some equanimity for us to keep on pushing toward the future, to keep on moving toward the future. Because a lot of aspects of what we see ahead of us in terms of ecological crisis, you know, the political craziness that's going on in this election year, all of that is not a pretty sight. And it may not be something that we really even want to engage with. Equanimity says, that's the way it is. That's the way things are. You need to stand in the middle of all this to be engaged and to be alive. The near enemy of equanimity is indifference. So, same message. That equanimity is not uncaring. It's not indifferent. It does not say, I don't really care how things turn out here. It does care, but it's not attached to the results. Another one of the traditional near enemies that is actually in the Visuddhimagga is unknowing. So Tony Bernhardt, who's speaking at SIM right now as I speak, says there's two kinds of ignorance. One is actually ignoring. And the base of ignorance, ignoring something, just kind of not even noticing it. The other one is knowing it, but in the wrong way, having the wrong view of something. So this unknowing that's the near enemy of equanimity is the first one. It's being so detached from something that we don't even see it and know it. Know it the way that you know your moods and the way that you know your thought patterns and things as we study them on this retreat, as we watch our minds. We're actually starting to get an intimacy and a knowledge even of the thought patterns that we don't like. And so this unknowing, this ability to shut our minds down and not even want to know what's happening is not equanimity. That's a near enemy. The far enemy is agitation. So the kind of the emotional, the equanimity, as Dennis mentioned earlier, isn't an emotion itself, but the emotions that can come with the mind state that is equanimity. Equanimity is a mind state. The emotions that can come with it can be rather cool. They can be calm, and the far enemy is agitation, and another far enemy is resentment. And it takes a couple of steps to get from equanimity to resentment as a far enemy, but equanimity accepts the way things are. Resentment takes the way things are, either pleasant or unpleasant, and doesn't like them, doesn't accept them, and then resents the fact either that someone else got something we didn't do, so that's the opposite of sympathetic joy, or is aversive toward what's happening. So it could be desire, aversion, lack of sympathetic joy. There can be a lot of manifestations of resentment, but all of them contain in them dissatisfaction with what's happening right now in the moment. And equanimity, as we develop it, gives us the ability to be with whatever's happening in the moment and be okay. Donald Rothberg developed a big list of contemporary forms of indifference. And it's kind of useful to listen to this list so that we can watch our mind state and test it against true equanimity. Denial, complacency, resignation, that's just collapse. It's like, oh, I can't do anything anyway, so wah, wah, wah. Acquiescence, same thing. Numbness, we've talked about that a couple times on this retreat, that numbness is not just neutrality. Numbness is actually damping down feeling at all, not feeling. Intellectual aloofness, you know, that's that rationalization I was talking about earlier. Oh, that's the next one on the list, rationalization. Cynicism, you know, we certainly see that in this political season, don't we? Dogmatism, is another, it's actually a form of indifference, because if you're dogmatic, you don't have to really think about why you're choosing to believe a certain thing. You don't have to feel it in your heart. Dogmatism gives you the luxury of just being able to spout what you claim you believe without having to actually engage with it. So I thought that was really insightful of Donald to think of dogmatism as a form of indifference. And the last one is really interesting. It's the fear of strong emotions, particularly anger. So I think sometimes we use fear of strong emotions as an excuse. We say, oh, I'm going to be so zen, as they say in the popular culture, you know. It's this sort of false calm that is not engaged with the world. And that the basis for that, the indifference behind that, much stronger than indifference, can be this cap that we put on our emotions. We're afraid that if we express them, they might rage out of control. Well, hey, guess what? The longer you suppress that, the worse it's going to be when it does rage out of control, right? So it's sort of a self-defeating act. Equanimity, as I mentioned, is on a number of Buddhist lists, and other than the Brahmaviharas, I'm only going to mention two tonight. The first one is the Paramis. So we spent almost 2 years a while ago at the suggestion of Steve Armstrong, who works with these quite a bit and recommends them as the practice for daily life. When Sim only met every other Thursday, on the alternate Thursdays, Sandra Sigrist led small discussion groups, and each one was about one of these paramis. And because they were so rich, we would often spend several sessions on one before we moved on. The paramis, in order, are generosity, and which is dana, virtue or morality, which is sila. And you might recognize those as the first two trainings that people often take in Asia when they undertake this Buddhist path, generosity and virtue, dana and sila. The next one is not often spoken about, but it's renunciation. And as I mentioned the other night, renunciation isn't always just a negative. We can actually look at renunciation as a real positive in terms of our progress on the path. Renunciation is developing finally the ability to put a little pause in between whatever triggers our reactivity and our acting that out in some kind of skillful way. It's actually a form of renunciation. It's saying, I'm not going to go there. I can feel that being, I can feel myself being triggered, but I recognize that if I follow through with that unskillful statement that I'm about to make in reaction to that trigger, I'm really going to hurt myself and other people, so I'm going to stop. A little pause right in there, that's actually a form of equanimity, but the decision not to do that thing is the renunciation. So it's actually quite a positive quality, and one that really bears exploration and practice. The next one is wisdom. One of that is virya, which is variously translated as energy or diligence, and we'll talk about that more when we get to the next list. Then comes patience. You don't hear this on many lists, but equanimity and patience are considered to be, of all of these, the two that work together to make all 10 of these work. Patience is Kanti in Pali, and the other way it's sometimes translated is forbearance, just the ability to, again, to be with something that might be unpleasant or difficult. The next one is truthfulness, which we know is one of the uh, the precepts that we're taking here is to be truthful in our speech, not to tell lies, not to use unskillful or untrue speech. The next one, aditana, is sometimes translated as determination, sometimes translated as resolve, resolution. And that's that quality that allowed the Buddha to sit down under the Bodhi tree that night and say, I'm not getting up from here until I'm enlightened. You know? It's not stubbornness. What it is it's taking your highest values, it's taking your intention and placing it out there as an aspiration and never losing sight of that. Always moving toward that. Not being willing to waver from that. So it's a wholesome quality, as opposed to stubbornness, which, you know, will, being a Taurus, I know this one well, will keep going toward whatever it wants and ignoring all the messages that are coming in about this is not the right path, you know. Determination or aditana doesn't have that, you know. When the Buddha sat down with that determination to reach awakening that night, he had all kinds of things come in and he was open to all of them. So resolve has that in, that sort of same feeling that you're continuously moving toward an aspiration, but it doesn't have that shutting out quality that stubbornness might have. And then the last two are loving kindness, metta, and upekkha, equanimity. So as same as in the Brahma Viharas, metta comes first and then equanimity. So the other list that I'd like to spend a little bit more time on is the seven factors of waking. Also called the seven factors of enlightenment. Bojanga in Pali. And the reason I like to talk about them is that they're very useful to know. It's useful to memorize this list and to get a feeling for it beyond just the words, because it's very useful in meditation, particularly on retreat when we have these ups and we have these downs, we have these surges of energy, and we have days when we feel like we just don't want to get out of bed. We have days that seem like they're really, really long, and then we have days when they go by and we say, well, what just happened? These qualities, the seven factors, are really useful to know and to work with, and they're all about balance. And that's another word for equanimity, is balance. Equanimity is a balancing factor. So just as we talked about earlier with the Brahma Viharas, equanimity balances metta, it balances mudita, it balances all of the other Brahma Viharas so that they can function in a wholesome way rather than being unwholesome. So this, the seven factors are about balance, and so there are seven of them, and mindfulness is at the top. And then there are two lists of three on either side. On one side are the energizing or arousing factors, and on the other side are the calming or tranquilizing factors. So that's why they're helpful to know, is that we want to balance the arousal with the calming. We want to balance the tranquility with the energy. So on the energizing side, the very first one is what's variously translated as investigation. Joseph Goldstein likes to call it discrimination of states, because he really emphasizes that of all seven, this is the wisdom factor. Dennis was using the term discernment the other day. This is discernment. This is the ability to recognize what mental state is present and to distinguish it from other mental states. And in so doing, we can skillfully work with whatever's arising, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. The next arousal factor is energy, virya. And we can think of energy as being sort of, hey, let's wake up in the morning and let's go. I just can't wait to get at it. But as you probably know from the days that you've already spent on this retreat, that only lasts so long, right? And eventually, with that kind of energy, it's going to peter out, and eventually there's going to be a crash because you just can't sustain that for a day, much less a 10-day retreat. So the word that Sayadaw Tejaniya likes to use for this is perseverance. So you can think of this kind of energy as maybe being more like a direct current. You know, it's perseverance. It's just always being there, always applying ourselves. It's not the kind of energy that's going to peter out when it's too frazzled. So perseverance, being willing to and able to actually stay with things. You know, whether that's the sitting that's maybe a little bit longer than you thought it would be, and say, let me just persevere here. Let me just stay on. Let me see what arises in response to that. Now, Sayadaw Tejaniya says that these first three factors are causes, and the other four are effects. So what that means is that really these are ones that you can actively work on and cultivate. Or in the case of energy, you might want to bring it down a little bit. You know, bring it up, bring it down. This list of seven is contained in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So, you know, we gradually have moved in this retreat not only through the Brahma Viharas, but we've also moved through the foundations of mindfulness. So we've gone to the body, to Vedana, the third foundation, mindfulness of mind. And this, Diane talked this morning about some of the hindrances, which are one of the lists that's in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. The seven factors are also on that list. And it's very informative to hear what the Satipatthana Sutta says over and over again in the fourth foundation of mindfulness about these seven factors. So you've heard us say on again and off again during this retreat, know why something arises, and know why something sustains, and know why it passes away. Right? The formula for these is a little bit different, and it's because they're all wholesome qualities. So in the fourth foundation, it says, one knows why the factor is present. One knows when the factor is present. One knows when the factor is not present. One knows how it arises. And one knows how it can be perfected by development. How it can be perfected by development. So beyond just sustaining, beyond the awareness that something is sustaining itself, these things we actually want to learn how to perfect them by development, because they're so useful. So the, you know, mindfulness as the balancing factor that's overlooking these is constantly evaluating, well, do I have enough of this? Do I have not enough? And, in its wisdom, is able to cultivate whatever is needed more. So, I'll get through the list and then I'll show you how they work across. The third energizing factor is rapture. And rapture is a particular form of joy. It's very energetic. It has this kind of jingly, jazzy, tingly quality to it. So, piti, it's called piti, and piti is the traditional metaphor for it is that piti is when you're dragging yourself across the desert and you see the oasis. It's that excitement. You see the oasis. So it's like, it gives you the energy to keep crawling across that sand and to keep going. But it's also quite energetic. It follows directly from energy. And I should say, each of these follows directly from the other. So, investigation brings energy. We've talked about that in some of the small groups. When you do investigation, it actually brings up brightness of the mind. Investigation brings energy. Energy brings this joy, this rapturous joy. Now, there's another word for happiness in Pali called sukha. And sukha is a much softer, more gentle, kind of pervading happiness. So while rapture is said to be what we might feel when we see the oasis, sukha is what we feel when we actually drink the water. It's that just, it doesn't have tons of energy. It's just that calm, abiding joy, happiness. Rapture is not that, but rapture is something that we really benefit on retreat. I think at times, almost all of you have expressed, this feeling of these little bursts of joy that you get, sometimes sustained for a while. Well, that's piti at work. And it's a result of your work. It's a result of your mindfulness, your investigation, and the energy. But it's an effect. You can't make yourself have this piti. Okay, so those are the energizing factors. Now, the tranquilizing factors, the first one is actually tranquility itself, pasadi. It's calm in the mind. It's a lack of restlessness, if you will, in the body. And I'll be talking about restlessness tomorrow in our 9:30 session. But it's tranquility of the body, and it's calm in the mind. The next one is concentration. So once we have calm in the mind, we can actually develop some concentration. And don't need to talk about this too much because we've talked about concentration, but just another reminder that concentration is not this furrowed-browed, tight focus. Concentration is a collectedness of mind that comes when all of these other factors come together. And concentration, samadhi, is a unifying factor. It takes all of our aspects of our experience and it integrates them. They say in Dipama that Jack Engler, who was an early friend of Steve Armstrong and of Joseph back in Massachusetts and is a professor of psychology at Harvard, he brought Dipama in and he gave her a Rorschach test. And what she did with that test, he said, let me get his exact words because it's extraordinary. I think I wrote him down. He said that she turned the Rorschach test into an ongoing spiritual story, a narrative that revealed the whole teaching of the Dharma and at the same time showed a clear comprehension of the tests, a remarkable achievement that none of the researchers had ever witnessed. That's the unifying power of samadhi. She had extraordinary powers of concentration. That's the unifying power of samadhi. That it's able to bring things together. And that's why insight arises when we have concentration. Insight puts together things that we may never have linked together. It has that power to be able to take one aspect of our experience and link it to another aspect of our experience in a way that we've never anticipated before. So, for example, I was on a retreat and I had this pattern that I was aware of on an intellectual level, and I've dreams and stuff of being blamed for stuff I didn't do. That was my framing of it, being blamed for stuff I didn't do. So I'd have these dreams of, these Kafka-esque dreams of being before the judge, and rah, 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 you're guilty, but I didn't do it. So So I was on this retreat, and at Spirit Rock, unlike here, if you're not in the sitting at the beginning, you're not allowed to go in after. So, you know, if you've got an interview group and it's done, you know, 20 minutes before the sitting's over, you don't go into the hall because they don't want you disturbing people. So it's the same thing. If you've started the sitting, you can't leave. That's just how it is. So I had a yoga job in the kitchen for lunch, and I went into the sitting before lunch. I don't remember anymore what time it started. Let's say it started 11:15. So it was sitting, and I've been sitting long enough. I pretty much know what it feels like after 45 minutes is up, because that's usually how much I sit every day. So I know what 45 minutes. 45 minutes was up, and the bell wasn't ringing. And I'm like, geez, my yogi job's at noon. You know, we got to get going here. And the insight teachers had left the yoga teacher in charge of the bell. So I'm like, that person, I don't know what they're doing. You know? They think that the sitting's over later, or they've fallen asleep, or I don't know what's going on. You know, it's their fault. So anyway, I'm a good boy, first of all, so I'm not going to jump up and leave in the middle of the sitting just because this darn yoga teacher isn't ringing the bell at the right time. So I sit the whole time, and yoga teacher rings a bell. I jump up, you know. I run down to the kitchen, and I get there. I see the schedule right there. You know, 12:15 is when the dumb thing is over. That's when he should have rung the bell. And my chore started at noon. I had misread the schedule, and had managed to find this yoga teacher to blame for my misreading the schedule. In that moment, you know, maybe because I'd just been sitting there for an hour, my mind took that old pattern of I'm always getting blamed for things I don't do. And it just completely flipped it around. And it said, you're blaming others for things that you do. It was just this little insight. You have this pattern of blaming others. And so I had covered that up with the story that I'm always getting blamed for stuff I don't do. And insight put these, somehow connected these things in a way that I would have never done myself. So we've said several times here, insight's always a surprise. If it wasn't, you would have thought of it already. So that somehow this unifying ability of concentration of samadhi to bring things together that weren't visible before is an amazing thing. The final one is equanimity. And it's instructive to think about these as the seven factors of awakening, and the last one is equanimity. Think about that. These are sequential. We're taking our mindfulness, we're doing investigation, we're arousing energy, that's leading to rapture. The rapture is allowing, as it fades away, as that energy goes away, it's bringing calm. That allows us to have concentration. The next thing is equanimity. I think sometimes in our mindfulness practice, we tend to think that it's all about the concentration, that the goal of all of this is just to be concentrated. We forget that there's more beyond that. There's more down the road. First of all, there's insight, knowledge, and there's wisdom. And then this equanimity itself, among some teachers, is actually equated with nibbana. That state of equanimity, that state of being at peace. The Buddha said the highest happiness is peace. That state of being at peace is equated by some to be nibbana. Now, Tony, again, I'll tell another little Tony story since he's on my mind tonight. He was on a retreat at the Buddhist Center for Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, and he actually asked one of the traditional Orthodox Vipassana Theravadan monks, is upekkha equal to nibbana? And the monk said, no. So traditionally that wouldn't be right, but there are people, especially secular Buddhists, that teach that maybe the state of equanimity is about as good as it gets in this life. I'll lead you to discover that for yourself. So So we've got mindfulness doing the balancing. We've got the three energizing factors. We've got the three tranquilizing factors. The other way to look at them is you can look at them straight across because they're sort of equivalent. So doing that, you've got investigation sitting across from calm. What that means is that if you're doing too much investigation, you may start getting restless. You may lose your calm. You need to balance those two. Energy is across from concentration. If your energy is not at the equal with the amount of concentration that you have, you're going to become restless. If you have too much energy and your samadhi isn't strong enough, you're going to become restless. Now, if you have a lot of concentration but the energy isn't there, you're going to fall asleep. The mind's going to become dull. It's going to slip off the object of the meditation. So those two need to be balanced. The interesting thing to know, and you might play with this in the next couple of days, is that you can bring either one of those up. They're both wholesome. They're both wholesome qualities. The energy and the concentration are both wholesome qualities. So, you know, if they're out of balance and mindfulness tells you that they're out of balance, okay, let's say that the samadhi is stronger than the energy, and so you're starting to fade a little bit. You notice your mind slipping off the object, you can't stay with it. You have two choices. You can bring the energy up so that it's equal to samadhi. Remember, energy is one of the things that we can cultivate. The other thing is you can back off on the concentration. So one way to do that might be to open it up a little bit. So the illustration that we use of you're on the breath and you're very finely noting the sensations at the nostrils. Well, you know, maybe if you're nodding off doing that, what you want to do is open up the awareness to the entire body. It doesn't mean that you're saying I'm not going to be concentrated anymore. You're diffusing your concentration into a larger object. You're allowing a little more space. You're allowing for a little bit more spaciousness in your concentration. And so you're equal, maybe you can equal it out to the amount of energy that you've got now. So learn to balance these things. And then rapture and equanimity, again, since they're both effects, there's not going to be a whole lot that you can do to maybe control those, but just to recognize with your mindfulness, well, maybe this giddy joyfulness is a little bit too much and I've lost my ability to be with the pleasant or the unpleasant because I'm liking this giddy joy so much that I'm holding on to the pleasant and that's all I want. I only want pleasant around me and I can't tolerate the unpleasant of either, you know, an unpleasant sound or an unpleasant sensation in the body or something like that. I'm losing my equanimity. You could recognize that. And then just start all over. Go back to investigation. See what that does for your energy. See if that can bring calm, and then if you can move through that. Bring rapture, and then if you can move through that to calm. So, if you know the way that the balance works, you can use arousing and calming in your meditation, and you can also use each of these factors to balance the other one. So usefulness to have, and the crowning endpoint of all of it is equanimity. Finish up with another Sharon Salzberg quote. And she says that equanimity is likened to the way parents feel when their children become adults. The parents have nurtured, have given so much care, have been loving, and then at some point they have to let go. They don't do so with a cold feeling of withdrawal. Equanimity has all of the warmth and love of the previous three states, but it also has balance, wisdom, and the understanding that things are as they are, and that we cannot ultimately control someone else's happiness and unhappiness. So we'll be doing our practice tomorrow with, I'll give you a big list of things that you can choose for whatever works for you tomorrow, and then you can keep the list. It's the one that John Travis made up. So look for that when you come in the hall tomorrow for the 3:45 session. I'll have it on the table. Pick it up as you come in, because I'll have you choose the one that works best for you that day. Equanimity, like compassion, you only use one or two phrases. But the traditional phrase is, all beings are the owners of their actions. Their happiness or unhappiness depend on their actions, not upon my wishes for them. That's the traditional one. And things are as they are is one of the ones that will be on that list. So, and as Steve Armstrong always adds, for now. But that is a deep understanding of impermanence. So things are as they are for now. Good thing to remember on retreat. Let's sit together for a moment. Let the words settle in.